This podcast is sponsored by ORC HSE Strategies, an industry leader in developing innovative and sustainable approaches for protecting workers and the environment. ORC membership includes EH&S vice presidents, directors, and senior managers from over 120 large global corporations in 20 different industry sectors. Many member companies like General Electric and Alcoa and GM and ExxonMobil and DuPont and Duke Energy and Siemens Healthcare Diagnostics and Allergan and Procter & Gamble and 3M have very well-established reputations as industry leaders in EH&S. That's like reading the greatest hits list. The value provided by the organization comes from harnessing the collective wisdom of all of these members and from the guidance and facilitation and expertise from the staff with decades of experience in EH&S. If you're interested in learning more about the unique opportunities available through ORCHSE, please contact Linda Haney at 202-510-0509. Or you can pop Linda an email at linda.haney@orchse.com. That's Linda, L-I-N-D-A dot Haney, H-A-N-E-Y, at orchse.com. Now, the podcast.
Give me like a five count. Let's hear what I got.
As in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1?
That's exactly. Now, that was very Australian because here on the other hemisphere, we'd have said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But that makes sense. That's perfect.
When you're upside down, everything is backwards.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your host, Todd Conklin. I am running this shindig. I'm driving this bus, baby. We're on a road now. We're going to go somewhere. Hey, thanks for tuning in. Today's fun because every day's kind of fun. I don't know what to think. Here we are, mid-November. I have no idea what's happened. I need to sort of catch up with this and figure it out later. Who knows? But by this point, everything is set in stone and moving forward. So maybe I'll attach a front end to this, but probably not. I got to record this early, so I got to get this done. Today's podcast is really interesting. This is one you're going to listen to. I don't know how much you know about Drew Ray, Dr. Drew Ray, Professor Drew Ray. He's from Griffith University. That's where Sydney Decker is in Brisbane, Australia, Brizzy. Drew is an engineer who has kind of a history of curiosity around safety, but where he gets really interesting is it's safety and storytelling. And the way I know Drew is through his podcast. I don't know if you've heard DisasterCast. It's fun. It's really interesting where he kind of digs in and tells the story of detailed failures. We'll talk about it in the podcast, but I was really dying to get Drew on and it kind of all worked out. I mean, everything was sort of perfect in a way. And so I contacted him. He said, let's do it. He'd love to be on it. We talked about sort of a cross-platform thing, and that kind of started this conversation. You're going to like this because this conversation, I will tell you, spares no sacred cows. So some people are going to probably be hurt by this a little bit. But he makes a really good case, and I think it's the right case, that really our zeal to put constructs around events is more about the fact that we do the investigation with the frame already decided. So we already know what an investigation is going to look like and what it's going to find, and we just go out there and just find it. And Drew's point, which is a good point, is that that's really not a function of bad investigators. That's a function of a bad investigatory model. And so what he says is, change the model and you'll change the world. And he talks a lot about safety and how we tell stories of both success and failure. And you're going to like this. It's good. I'm a big proponent of the fact that we tell lots of scary stories in the belief that it'll scare people into being better. But in fact, it's not worth a crap. What we have to do is talk about stories of how things happened and how success is created in normal variability. Because it's about creating success in normal variability. If you haven't picked that up yet, it's time to sort of snap to and listen. You're going to listen. You're going to probably want to rewind. You're going to probably want to listen again. It's that kind of podcast. There's a moment in this podcast, you'll hear it, were, quite honestly, I think probably one of the most interesting things that's ever been said is said. So listen carefully. Without any further ado, I'll just kind of toss it open and say, Drew, introduce yourself and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast.
Hi, I'm Drew Ray. I'm a lecturer at Griffith University. I'm an engineer by training. Joined the Defence Forces as a civilian early in my life. Got interested in safety, went back to school, worked for railways, worked in Boston, in York, in the UK. And now I'm back here in Brisbane in a school of social sciences studying safety.
Very cool. Well, I found you, I knew about you a long time ago, but I really found you and kind of fell in love with you. Yes, I said it, fell in love with you on the DisasterCast podcast. What got you to start that? That's such an interesting podcast. It's really, it's kind of a deep dive into events and it's really thoughtful.
So there's a cynical side of it and a fun side of it. The cynical side of it is that in safety, to get your ideas out, you've got to have a brand. Andrew Ray, safety academic, his ideas get written in obscure papers and published in obscure journals. Andrew Ray, Drew Ray, the disaster cast guy, people know who you are. They've got something to hook onto. But that sort of ties into then the fun side of it, which is that if you want to sell ideas, having stories to tell is important. And so that's really disaster cast. I had all of these accident stories that I thought, well, I've got these students and engineers who they are learning about safety, but they've never really heard the details of Challenger or Columbia or Three Mile Island or Deepwater Horizon. And I wanted to share some of the rich details of those stories.
And it's fun because it's really thoughtful. It's pretty well researched. It's actually very well researched and it's a deep dive. But what interests me about you, and this is really what got me sort of thinking about you, is how you've thought about the storytelling. And you know, our tendency in safety is to really tell scary stories. We try to scare people into being safe, which is just ridiculous and stupid and kind of goofy, but everybody does it.
Yeah, so this started off with an episode I was writing for the podcast, just one of these bizarre ideas, because one of the other podcasts I listen to is Story Wonk, which is all about analyzing stories. And they introduced me to an idea that there are these seven universal tales. There's the hero who goes on a journey. There's the person who discovers themselves. Stories like that, that are just sort of a universal instantiated in different ways. And it got to the point where I was wondering, do we just keep repeating the same accidents over and over again? That we just have these patterns of disaster that happen. And so I tried to come up with a set of seven patterns. And once I realized what I was doing, I just suddenly got horrified that, gosh, this is what we do when we investigate accidents, is we construct stories based on these patterns that we already know about. And we do it just to try to reinforce messages that we already know about. And that's not what we tell ourselves we're doing when we claim to be investigating and learning.
Oh, you're completely true. In fact, I just did a peer assist with a company and I looked at a whole bunch of their accident investigations. And it won't surprise you, but it kind of surprised them that they all were the same. Every one of them had the same finding. Every one of them had the same sort of outcome. Every one of them had the same direction towards corrective action. And they'd really gotten in this loop where they sort of had the story and they kind of looked for events to fill it. It's kind of goofy when you think about it because you don't really need to investigate if your outcome's always the same. I mean, you're kind of wasting time investigating, don't you think?
Yeah, I tried that out actually recently when I was talking to a bunch of people who ran heads of department for schools. And they wanted to investigate an accident that happened at a school fair, a FATE. And I said, well, what do you really want to produce by way of useful output for this? Who is the audience? And they said, well, really, we want to give good advice to people who are organizing FATEs. So I asked them, what are you going to learn by doing the investigation that will help you write better advice? Can't you just sit down and write that advice right now? And they scratched their heads and thought, yeah, they could. They could produce all of the outputs that they wanted to produce, and they weren't going to investigate to learn anything.
So what's a FATE?
Like a carnival.
Oh, really?
Show, you know, where you've got like sideshows and stalls selling cakes.
Yeah.
And banners up everywhere and showing off the school.
I never knew that had a name. I've learned some. It's the best podcast ever. I learned something new today. I'm going to go out and use the word fate a lot. Well, that's interesting. When they realized that they didn't need to even do the investigation to write the outcome, what'd you tell them? How'd you move ahead with that?
Well, I asked them what they didn't know about fates that they could try to find out.
Nice.
And it turned out that actually there was lots of stuff that they could learn about fates, because schools get really scared when there are events that happen outside their control. And things that happen on the weekends are a great example. The school shuts up at 3 o'clock and everyone goes home. And then the volunteers come in and start setting up banners and stalls and using the school's equipment. And that's frightening, but also it's something that they don't know a lot about. Why was the guy standing up a ladder trying to hang something up? Well, maybe it was because all the school's equipment was actually behind a locked door they didn't have the key to.
Right.
What are the activities that need to go into setting up a fate? Who does what? How do they organize it? Turned out the people who run the school don't actually know that. So if they want to provide good advice, yes, there were things that they could learn once they had actually thought through what did they not know? What were they curious about?
That's so interesting. So if you had to give advice to safety managers, because you kind of know who listens to this podcast. So it's safety people, a lot of high-performance computing people, pilots, doctors, nurses, you know, the crowd. That's a good crowd. If you were going to give them advice around this notion of stories and safety, what would you say? Where would you go with this?
I would start with the idea that you've got to be curious to decide that you don't know everything, that you want to find something out. So this is what I do when I want to learn about an accident, is I don't assume that I know what happened. I don't sort of write the podcast and then go back and check the sources. I say, well, okay, what do I not know about this? What am I interested, curious about? Where are the inconsistencies or sort of black bits where people skate over that I want to find more about? And that curiosity, that assuming that there is something that other people can tell you instead of the other way around, is always at the heart of learning new things. You know, students who go into a classroom thinking that they already know everything and never going to learn. Investigators who think that they can tell people how to be safe are never going to learn. They might successfully tell people how to be safe, but they won't actually investigate. They'll just communicate.
So that preconceived bias sort of sets up, it's really kind of a confirmation bias in a way, isn't it? I mean, they sort of set up reasons to support what they thought already.
Yeah, and the big clue is paradoxical. It's when someone says, I'm going into this investigation with an open mind. That's your clue that someone is ready for bias, because they haven't. They don't see and acknowledge the way in which everything is preconceived by your own structures of thinking about things. And the only way to avoid it is to stop asking questions, because every question has loaded in it assumptions, structures about what's important, what's not important. And the alternative, instead of saying, you know, what happened, why did it happen, where did it happen, who was involved, is to get people to tell a story. So you stop asking questions. You just tell people, tell me a story about this.
And they get to build it, and it moves over time. Are you familiar with Fisher and his fidelity around stories? He's a communication scholar, and he says that stories have to hang together temporally so they make sense in time, and that they have fidelity. They sort of move towards meaning. They move towards fidelity. And you're right, Drew, because when I do – I'm on an investigation today, actually. So I spent today looking at a fatality, and it's really interesting because I don't start at the accident and go backwards, and I don't have any questions. In fact, I'll be really honest. I don't think I've ever told anybody this. I don't even really read ahead before I get in there. I just sat down with a room of people and said, tell me how that day started. And then I shut up and just listen. And it kind of forces them into that storytelling. Why are stories so valuable?
Let me dodge the question slightly.
Yeah, oh, dodge away. Dodge away. We are in charge of all dodging, so dodge like crazy, baby.
I wanted to hook into the stuff you were saying about Fisher. I'm not directly familiar with Fisher and fidelity, but one of the books on my safety shelf is a thing called The Writer's Journey by Vogler. which makes very clear how these decisions about where the endpoint of the story is and where the start point of the story is and who the actors are already predetermine where the conflict is in the story. So by the time you've asked someone, tell me about today, you've already selected that that person is going to be the star of the story. They're the person taking action. You've already selected that the relevant time frame is from the beginning of that day. So anything that happened before the day is now out of scope of the story.
Yeah, you're right. You're totally right.
These are necessary things in order to tell stories. You can't tell a good story without making those decisions. But the more consciously you make them, the more crafted the story is. So actually, one of the ways around it is not to make those decisions on behalf of other people, but to get them to tell the story based on what they think is most interesting, most important. Now, the challenge is that they'll be trying to read your mind. So you go to someone and say, well, when did this all start? They'll assume that, well, you're interested only in the accident, so you're only interested in the minutes beforehand. So perhaps by saying, you tell me about the start of today, at least you're giving them that space and permission to say that things don't happen just in the space of the accident, but stories unfold over a longer period of time.
And as they tell the story, it's really interesting because they find, at least today's example, is they kept reaching back farther and farther. So you're right. It is kind of an artifact. A storyteller is more like a painter than a scientist, for sure. They choose the point of view. They chose the depth of field. They chose the colors by which we paint, like a painter does. But it's really interesting, and I love what you're saying, because we allow the story to sort of unfold towards whatever it is we need to think about, the potential outcome or the event or the accident or disaster, if we're talking about a disaster cast. But building up to it is really where all the context lies. And the context is really where most of the learning is. Because I agree with you completely. If I could do anything to leaders, it would be to make them so much more curious. Curiosity seems to be the most powerful place you can be in safety, and correct me if you think this is wrong, is not knowing. Because not knowing allows you to know. It allows you to learn. If you think you know already, then you have no desire and no real reason to do any kind of investigation. But if you don't know, the world is completely open. It's almost tabula rasa, if I can use a bit of Latin.
There's a flip side to that. It's all very well for me sitting in an academic office to be deeply, deeply uncertain about safety, to be sure that I have no idea how to make things actually safer, to talk about the fact that cause is not a scientific term, it's a psychological term, it's an illusion. But it's a much harder job for someone who is in an operational management position who has to give people definite answers. And so there's got to be some compromise to be reached between the deep uncertainty and the willingness to give people at least some form of sense-making that they need in order to move forward.
So how do we reach that? What do we do with that?
I think the first step is being self-conscious about the fact that, yes, even though we are telling stories, we're conscious about the fact that we're telling stories. And just acknowledging and admitting that this is just one point of view, this is one story, is a good start. The next one is recognizing that you don't have to reconcile stories. If you've got three different people telling you stories about an accident and they all seem to contradict each other, you don't need to resolve those contradictions in order to come up with good recommendations. You don't need to say it was found that this person is wrong and this person is right, or here are three ways it might have happened and the committee decides that this is the way that it did actually happen. If all three were possible, were reasonable, all three can lead to useful learnings, useful actions. You don't need to know and settle on one unified story.
Oh, but Drew, that's very controversial, because are we not more like policemen than we are listeners of stories? He says sarcastically.
Now you're just trying to provoke me, because no safety person actually wants to be called a safety cop.
And yet, I spend tons of my time with companies who say, you know, these stories didn't jive, somebody's lying, when in reality, you're exactly right. If three different people were involved in an event, there's going to be three different perceptions of that event. And if they're three reasonable stories, all of them have value operationally. Fair enough?
So here's the deeply pragmatic thing about playing safety cop. There are regulators and there are enforcement agencies who sometimes need to find someone to blame. And that's something that organizations don't like, that fight against. But there is absolutely no need for an organization to do that to themselves.
I agree. So,
Ben, you're not even helping. Go on.
Well, no, that should be the headline of everything. I mean, that may be one of the more profound things I've heard in years, what you just kind of squirted out there. That was amazing.
You don't need, even for the sake of safety, to blame yourself as an organization for things going wrong. You're doing the job of the people who need to blame. So a classic thing is an organization will produce an accident report and say, it has found that our supervision was deficient. And it achieves nothing to do that. No supervisor is going to improve their supervision because some safety geek has come and told them they're a bad supervisor. The regulator is going to be tearing their hair out because they weren't planning to prosecute, but now they've got documentary evidence forcing them to prosecute because you've just admitted breaking the law by providing deficient supervision. And no one has learned anything about what supervision is, could be, should be, might be. But organizations keep wanting to do this, your findings in recommendations, coming to definite conclusions.
Why do you think that's the case?
Bad habit?
Man, I was afraid you'd say that. I wanted it to be, I don't know. I don't know what I wanted it to be. But I do think it's kind of bad habit. I think they believe that's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, I don't even think it's one of those things that is psychologically necessary. Sense-making is necessary. People, after an accident, have had their worldview disrupted.
Yes.
The way they thought things were is not how it was, and the world is a scarier place. It needs to return back to normal. So the need to have explanation, the need to have sense-making is important. But this idea about language and root causes and findings, all of those are rituals that have built up around the sense-making. And you can strip those back and still provide very psychologically satisfying stories and very positive recommendations to improve the future.
In fact, if I may, I think when you strip those back, you provide more satisfying and more effective recommendations for the future. The causal trap that people fall into sort of makes them respond in quite a linear fashion. That's how you write the same corrective actions for a million different investigations. It's really that open sort of understanding of the holistic nature of what either happened or could happen that draws people into more imagination. They're more creative. They're certainly more appreciative.
Yes, I agree. I think we've trained ourselves in particular types of language that this is, to use a storytelling term, this is the genre we're writing in. You know, an accident story always starts with, you know, it was a Boeing 737 operating as flight AK-543, traveling at 2,000 knots. The pilot was we're introducing a genre, and that genre tells us that we need to talk about things like root causes, like findings, like conclusions. But there are plenty of other stories that are equally satisfying that don't fit that same genre. And I like the idea of just sort of switching that and saying, okay, this is a workplace appreciation. It's a different type of writing. It serves the same ultimate end of sense-making, of providing a way forward, but it does it without any of those conventions of the bad hack writing.
Amazing and so interesting. What do you think about appreciative inquiry, David Cooper writer?
My biggest concern with it is not the underlying philosophy, which I think is good. It's that it still falls into the trap of asking questions rather than collecting stories. And it asks the questions with a particular mind frame that hits on the difficult intersection between safety one and safety two, which is that there are some things which are bad. And we know they're bad because they lead to bad outcomes. And safety two particularly as it's expressed through appreciative inquiry, doesn't like to recognize that. And so this is what makes Safety One people very uncomfortable, is, but hold on, the operator is not always right. The operator could have been, should have been, might have been doing things differently, and you're ignoring the possibility of doing it differently by saying, well, you guys are the experts. You guys knew what you were doing. You guys know why you did it that way. So I like the philosophy, but it's not quite right yet. It's a work in progress, and we need to consider it as a work in progress rather than as a ready-made solution.
And I think Cooperrider would agree with you. I mean, Cooperrider's premise is that one of the ways we can change the discussion is by changing the question. And he makes no bones about the fact that when you slant your questions towards appreciative, you know, discovery, you're going to get a lot of appreciative discovery without sort of the heavy lifting of all the whinging and complaining and all the things that sort of come on the opposite of appreciative discovery. And that's kind of a cool idea. But I think you're right. I mean, and it's interesting to think about it in a more formal investigation protocol. I really think a lot about sort of informal learning, kind of ad hoc learning, and that's where I think these safety stories make a difference. Why have we drifted, and I'm kind of redirecting you back to this question, why have we drifted to the belief that somehow bad stories are meaningful? You know, the story of the bad failure, the story of the bad actor, the guy that gets up and talks about how stupid he was, and that's why he's injured, or those kind of stories. Why have we gotten to a place where we think that makes a difference?
One of the reasons is that that's a very satisfying form of sense-making for people who've stuffed up. If you've been involved in the events leading up to an accident, you have two very psychologically easy ways to get out of it. One of them is to deny completely that it was your fault, to say that, look, this is someone else's problem, someone else's responsibility. I did the very best I could, and despite me being the hero of this story, bad things happened. Now, I won't name names, but you can see that clearly in a lot of people talking about accidents beforehand, afterwards, that they're casting other people as the bad actors and themselves as the noble people going down fighting. But the other alternative is actually more common and more sinister, which is to stick your hand up and say, I stuffed up. I'm the villain here. I did things badly. And I'm an object lesson to myself and other people. Classic example of this, and I will call out names, is the Hyatt Regency walkway collapse. The guy who ran the engineering consultancy firm, who was responsible for the diagrams which got mistranslated through many layers of contracting and subcontracting and missed out important design details, he took personal responsibility for that error and spent the rest of his life lecturing engineering students about personal responsibility. And the amount of harm that that does is incredible, because it wasn't his fault. The idea that the leader of an engineering organization should be micromanaging every diagram is ridiculous. If anything, he could have taken lessons out of that about how it's important for engineers to learn management skills and learn delegation and learn how to run organizations, not just to be engineers. That would have been useful stuff. But instead, he's taken his own guilt and moral lesson and spreads that round. And that's his way of making sense and making compensation for this bad thing that happened. And that's why we have so many people who've been injured who are willing to become volunteers to stand up on stage and say, look, I got injured. It was my fault. If you don't be like me. But it's unhelpful, because I don't think that's a particularly I hesitate to use the word accurate, because all sense making is sense making, but I don't think it's a particularly useful form of making sense of what happened.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do with the information is the point I'm sort of always at. I feel terrible, and I'm sorry it happened, and I'm sorry you feel that way, but I don't know how to process that information and make a difference operationally.
Yeah, I actually talked to someone who was in the audience for a big football star whose father had been killed in an industrial accident. And he's now a spokesman for workplace health and safety. He goes around giving these talks. And he gives talks about his own irresponsibility And the number of times when he has done things which were unsafe and been scared by the consequences or near misses, and how he's just like his father was, who was involved in the accident. And I was talking to a person in the audience because I wanted to see, you know, forget my own impressions, what does someone who's coming at this cold take away? And what he took away was, oh my gosh, it really doesn't work, does it? This guy's own father was killed and he went through all these things. It took all of that and he's still making mistakes with safety. You, what lesson are you supposed to come out of it? Care, but care doesn't help unless you have a direction to put the caring into.
Remarkable. So if you had to give one piece of information, and I know this is kind of limiting, but you'll make it, I promise. If you had to give one piece of information, one piece of advice around this notion of using stories to understand and learn from operational activities, what would it be?
Don't tell stories, collect stories.
What'd you think, huh? I don't even know where to guess, but where do I begin to talk about this? He's an interesting cat. He's got a book coming out soon, which I'm sure I'll talk about more on the podcast, which sounds interesting. But his stuff around, I mean, he really sort of takes these fear stories to task and says they're not just bad. They actually send the wrong message and do the wrong things. I think his notion that there are people that need to blame the regulator, right, the compliance enforcement people. But if organizations who don't need to blame choose to blame, they're actually putting themselves in a position where they're making blame decisions that simply don't need to be made. That is very powerful. Holy guacamole. Ay. I don't know. What are you thinking about the podcast? Are you, any ideas or concepts? Or I haven't asked this in a long time, but if you've got people you think should be on this, tell me. Got a couple cool people lined up for sure. So that's good news. Other than that, the podcast is going great. I mean, gosh, thanks. You know, we're well over 200,000, which is a big deal, and that's kind of cool. Mostly it's just good stuff. The dumb YouTube page is even getting a lot of hits on it. So I think everybody's kind of enjoying it. It's doing exactly what I hoped it would do. And I hope it's doing what you hoped it would do. And I hope it's not boring or stupid or anything. I mean, I don't know. Give me some feedback. Tell me what you think. For sure, subscribe. Tell your friends. Get some people to listen. That makes a huge difference. As always, learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be a good storyteller. No, be safe.